I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Merle Hoffman. She is the author of the new book, Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Very good to be with you today.
So this is a really fascinating autobiography, and in many ways it's an exploration of power in its many manifestations, particularly women's power. You were training to be a concert pianist. How did you get into the field of women's health?
It's very serendipitously. Yes, my family is very musical, and from the ages of about 10 to 19, I was spending the majority of my time practicing 3 or 4 hours a day to be a concert pianist. And as time went on, I realized that it would be far too hermetic for me. And I graduated music and art high school, and I thought, well, I would just travel around Europe and sort of find myself. And I went through a lot of different iterations. I was in drama and painted, and eventually I thought it would be a good idea to go to college. And I was interested so much in psychology, so I did start college for psychology. And in order to put myself through school, I had sometimes 2 to 3 part-time jobs while I was going. And one of them was with a physician, a Dr. Martin Gold, who was involved with the HIP program, which is the health insurance plan. And in 1970, while I was in college and working, the abortion law changed in New York. And New York was one of 4 or 5 states that decriminalized abortion prior to 1973. And Dr. Gold and his partner wanted to provide abortion services for HIP subscribers. And I got involved with the project. And at the time, it was a small project, and just to provide these services. And the first patient who came was a patient from New Jersey. And she came from New Jersey because abortion was still illegal in that state. And she was white and in her 20s and married with 1 child. And she was pregnant and didn't want to be. She couldn't be because she just couldn't afford to have another child. So here I was in just psychology theories in my head, but I spoke to her, practically counseled her, actually did, stayed with her throughout her abortion, held her hand, and it was that catalytic moment. It was being with her in that most powerful and vulnerable moment when she was having her abortion that actually inspired me and has been my work for the past 4 decades.
Even after Roe versus Wade, and New York, as you say, legalized abortion a couple of years before Roe v. Wade, but even after that, and it was a huge change, abortion patients in particular were very much under the authority of their doctors, who were mostly male. And you describe in your book what this was like for women and what your role as counselor was to counteract some of that. What did it actually look like?
Yeah, it was, I began to call it iatrogenic pregnancies that I would see. Iatrogenic means caused by the system, but in this case, it was caused by the physicians, the male physicians, you see, because at that time, there was no Our Bodies, Ourselves. There was no way that women could access information about their own bodies, birth control, abortion, birth. I mean, it was all held by the brotherhood, the physician brotherhood. So women would be going to physicians to get birth control. You know, they started seeing their doctors, which was the second most intimate relationship that they had, aside from their husbands or lovers, when they were about 14 or 15, when they would start menstruating, and if they would go to get birth control. And I began to see women coming into choices for abortions, and they would tell me things like, oh, you know, my doctor told me I didn't have to refit my diaphragm after my last pregnancy, or my doctor said, oh, you know, you can go off the pill and use foam. Or another one would say, you know, the doctor gave me pills, but I'm really not comfortable taking pills, but he gave it to me because he said he gives all his women the pills. So I began to see a very, very strange strong pattern here, and the pattern was that women were actually, because they couldn't get the information, getting pregnant when they didn't want to be because of the misinformation of their physicians. So it became increasingly, increasingly frustrating to me. And then I remember one day when I heard another horror story, I just walked up to my office and I started writing down what I started to call the tenets of patient power, that the patients have the right to question their doctors. They have the right to the information, that they have a right to second opinions, that they have a right not to be intimidated, that they have a right to accurate information. And this was quite radical at the time. It's very, very funny. I created a poster where I had imagined God with a big, instead of a thunderbolt, an RX coming down, and patients around with placards saying, "We have a right to question you. We have a right to information." And actually, I sent them around to a lot of medical groups, and some of the administrators tore them off the walls. It was really an insurrection. If you think about the Reformation, that's what it was. It was like a Reformation. I wanted to translate the medical information into a language that women could understand. They couldn't understand anything. And without knowledge, there is no choice or power. So that's what patient power was about.
And, I mean, the change between then and now is huge. When I think about my own early experiences with that stuff, it was all very female positive and body positive and things like that. And one forgets that you and your colleagues were doing the work to get that done.
Yeah, but unfortunately, we're still, even at this time, 40 years later, there's still a great amount of ignorance among a lot of women, mainly the disenfranchised and poor women, because they don't have access to the family planning facilities or even the literature to learn these things. And then if they live in a state where all they teach is
abstinence.
Right. Right. I didn't want to think about that. That's all they teach in terms of birth control and family planning is abstinence. They're going to still, you know, get involved with these iatrogenic pregnancies.
So you, Merle Hoffman, in your mid-20s, came to be the director of an abortion clinic in New York, and your own authority was challenged. And one of the things I like about this book is that you're very honest about the mistakes that you made and about the learning process that you went through. But people were challenging you, I think probably because you were young, because you were a woman, and because you weren't a doctor. How did you handle all of that?
That wasn't easy. First of all, yes, you have to imagine, here I am, 25, 26 years old, and doctors come in to do procedures, and I would stay in the room with them. I would make sure that I had to stay in the room with them, because sometimes they would make very many misogynistic remarks. I mean, you know, there was no general, we didn't give general anesthesia then, so the women would have local lidocaine, but it was still, you know, pretty uncomfortable, you know, it's strong cramping. So I'd have to stay with them and hold their hands and tell them how to breathe. And, you know, if the doctors were difficult, I'd speak to them outside. So I had the challenge from the doctors. But that was worked through, and also Dr. Gold helped with that. But the challenge, the interesting one I got, was from the staff, because, you know, it was a time of feminist awakening, and you speak about issues of power, and I was always involved with thinking about, concerned with power, and here I was, I had power. I could hire and fire and set directives, and you know, in the beginning, I wanted to be friendly, take them to dinner, talk to them, mainly the counselors and the nurses, and that didn't work out very well, because we were in a building that housed another HIP group that was unionized. So about, 77, 78, I was unionized, and I only had about 8 employees. And the union came in, and I found that I had to negotiate a union contract for 8 employees, and it was an enormous learning experience. And what happened afterwards was very interesting, because I thought the only way that I could now manage this, because I felt I was totally violated. I had a small clinic. Now I have 20 pages of a contract. And when somebody would come in before the union and say, well, I was late, I just couldn't get up, or my baby was bothering me, you know, I would let it go. But now I would say, well, we have to write you up, and this goes in your file. So I stuck specifically to what the union contract directed me to do. And after a year, the employees were so frustrated with this, they actually voted the union out. So now I call my management style a collective autocracy. I listen to everybody. I'm very open to hear specifically things that don't agree with my vision, because I want it to be tested. But in the end, I make the decision, because I'm the one that's responsible for it.
It was such an interesting couple of pages in that book, and I think very instructive to young people who are learning management, particularly women who fall into the traps of, I mean, when you would ask women how they felt about power, and they all said, well, I don't want power over, I want to empower. And that's a beautiful thing, but it's not necessarily how to manage an organization.
No, there's an enormous reticence among a lot of people, a lot of women particularly, about power. And it's as if it's a static thing, and power is negative as it is. But I learned that power is a force that ebbs and flows, that moves and goes with the people who use it. I mean, I was in Beijing in 1995 for the International Women's Conference, and I gave a talk in front of Japanese therapists. They asked me, well, you know, as a feminist, how do you feel about the power that you have when you counsel or give a therapeutic session to a patient? I mean, isn't that antithetical to being a feminist? And I had to say, no, absolutely not. That, you know, the power of knowledge, the power of wisdom, the power of being in a journey and having passed those road marks prior to another is a good power. It's the power of teaching, the power of mentoring, the power of inspiring. But women are very reticent, very reticent.
We're talking to Merle Hoffman about her book, Intimate Wars. So when you started out working with abortion clinics, working with women, counseling them, what demographics did you see? What ages? Who was coming in for abortions, and what were their reasons?
In the beginning, everybody. I mean, it was all races. You know, a lot of, I would say, teenage to 30s, different socioeconomic groups, because the clinics were the first ones that came up to serve that population. And the reasons actually then are the same that they are now. 73% of women now, we just did a study, found that they have abortions for economic reasons. They can't take care of the children that they have. You know, it's impossible. They're in the middle of their, you know, their life or their doctorate, or their husband can't afford. It's a theme with multiple variations, but they're all similar, because it's always a survival decision. So what has changed, though, over the years is that now the clinics have become so much of a pariah in society because of the harassment and the violence and all of the obstacles and obstructionist legislation, that basically a lot of middle class or upper class women will go to individual doctors and won't go to clinics. And clinics have gotten sort of a name of Medicaid mills or something. They've been thrust into that kind of thing.
It's so ironic on a number of levels that the conservative political agenda is really counter to the stated political agenda around abortion. So in other words, if you wanted to reduce abortions, you'd have A, wonderful birth control so that you wouldn't have very many abortions, and B, you'd redistribute wealth so people wouldn't be having abortions for economic reasons.
Absolutely, but that's thinking very clearly and logically, and this is not what the thought process on that side is. You know, I just did a press conference last Tuesday in Washington. that I called Abortionomics, where I presented these exact arguments that 73% of women are having abortions for economic reasons, that the majority of women who have abortions are poor and disenfranchised, that the majority of women have abortions attempted to or wanted to prevent unwanted pregnancy but could not because they didn't have access, availability, or funds to do that, that because of that, they were thrust into a situation of getting later and later term abortions. So we can look forward, I think, now to a pre-Roe reality where more and more states will have more and more restrictive obstacles to access these services, and more women will once again have illegal procedures. Because you know something, they won't stop having abortions. I mean, that everyone knows. That history has shown us. So the question isn't whether women will have abortions. The question is whether women will die in the process of attempting to.
How did you get politicized? You write that in the first years that you were doing this, it was really a women's health thing, but then one day it really became a political thing.
Right. I was totally apolitical for quite a few years. But one morning, I woke up in 1976 to the sounds of the radio, and I heard Republican Congressman Henry Hyde's voice saying something like, if we can't save all the babies in America, we can at least save some of the babies. We can save some of the babies of the poor, which translated into the Hyde Amendment, which took away Medicaid coverage for the bulk of poor women in this country. Now, these were the women that I saw every day. These were the women that I dealt with. And I found it so extraordinarily discriminatory and egregious that I said, oh, what can I do? What can I do? You know, and so I write up a pamphlet, one piece of paper, and I go to Queens College, which was my alma mater where I had graduated undergraduate. And I walk down the halls, and I just knock on the professor's door and ask if I can address their class. And I went in, and I said, my name is Merle Hoffman, and I'm here to tell you that poor women will die. The Hyde Amendment has been passed, and now poor women will have to go to either, if they can afford to get somebody to do it, to somebody who can help them, or they're just going to die. And the reaction was, well, you know, it's not us. These were white middle-class kids at Queens. So it's not us. We can always go to Puerto Rico or London if, you know, we have that problem. So I saw very clearly what has been a long-term issue, this bifurcation of race and class in the movement, and how if something is not giving you a 2x4 on the head and it doesn't happen to you immediately, you know, there's not enough radical empathy among people to have them activated. So that's what politicized me.
We're talking to Merle Hoffman. It's interesting, you make a distinction between the people who were activating for abortion rights on the one hand and the women who were getting abortions on the other, who weren't necessarily coming in as flag-waving pro-choice people. They weren't necessarily even politicized.
Not at all. You know, because this is not a decision of politics. This is a decision of necessity. And a lot of women who came in, and I did an earlier study on abortionomics, said that they weren't, not even were they not pro-choice, they were anti-choice. They never thought that they would ever, ever, in a million years, get into a situation where they'd have to make a decision to have an abortion. But they did, and there they were, sitting in the waiting room like everybody else. And, you know, I began to call that the rape, incest, or me position. You know, I'm against abortion. I'm against abortion. All of a sudden, it happens to me, and I'm not against abortion. But that did not politicize them. I mean, they had their procedure, and in some cases, colleagues of mine told me that they knew of anti-choice demonstrators that had procedures and went right back to the picket lines. So it was very difficult and still remains difficult to politicize the vast majority of people who have had abortions or have had experience with abortions. Now, if you think about this, 1 out of 3 American women have had and will have an abortion by age 45. That's an amazing number. 1 out of 3.
That's huge. That's really high.
Right, right. And you think about the family, the friends, lovers, partners. I mean, that is the majority of the country. It's ubiquitous. You know, that's why I said, abortion is as American as apple pie. And I've been, you know, people freak out when they hear that. But it's true.
So what is going on? I mean, there's these two sides, the so-called right to life and the right to choose. They're lined up against each other. And you actually make the case in a very thoughtful way that they don't really have to be lined up against each other, and that the beauty of giving life and all of that can be respected even while the right to choose is respected.
Yeah, I definitely believe that and have always believed that, but that's not something that the other side can ever accept or will ever be able to deal with, because they firmly believe that abortion is murder, and as such, they are going to do everything they can to stop the murder. There have been attempts from some organizations and some people at what they call common ground, and I've never seen that as a possibility, because the common ground, I mean, there's obvious common ground. The common ground is, if you want less abortions, let's do everything in our power to make sure that we have an educated public on birth control, abortion, and all of those other issues. But they're against birth control also. So that's the problem.
What is going on in their psychology? In other words, how can they be, what is their vision? I mean, given that abstinence is a joke, it's a non-reality.
Yeah, but you see, you know, you can't expect this pure vision of sexual abstinence to have any effect with reality. There is no reality in this situation. So their vision is one of, well, if we don't really talk about it, if we don't really address it, they won't do it. You know, the reason why young women have so many abortions is because there's so much family planning discussion, or we talk about family planning or abortion or birth control. If we deny it, it'll go away. So I think on some level it's really magical thinking, but it's really black magic, because the results of their thinking just increase the abortion rates. You know, I have debated all of the leaders of the movement, even Jerry Falwell, and I have given up, in a sense, trying to go even deeper to their psychology, because your question is asked by everybody, but how can they? How do they? How can they? They do, and they do very comfortably. They do very easily. And my issue at this point is just to make sure that their agenda doesn't get actualized more than it is. Here's another interesting incident. I was giving a reading in Washington last week, and I walk into the bookstore, and there's a woman sitting out there, and she looks at me, and she's giving out literature. And she said, oh, I was pro-choice, I was pro-choice. I said, good, good. She said, but then I had an abortion, and I've regretted it my entire life. And I said, but that's okay. You know, women have the right to make the wrong choice. And that's something that they won't accept either. You know, there's all sorts of organizations, American Victims of Abortion, Women Exploited by Abortion. Their entire belief is that they regretted it, they should have never done it, if they only knew the truth. But that's a disingenuous argument, because they have the right to make the choice, but there is no guarantee it's the right one.
Merle Hoffman, you saw the surge of the anti-choice movement, and particularly after the election of Ronald Reagan. What did that look like? I mean, you basically had to cross lines of protesters in front of your own clinic.
Yeah, I had to cross lines of protesters. We had death threats. We had bomb threats. You know, providers were murdered. There were invasions. Operation Rescue came to New York in droves. It was a war. It was a hot war at that time, and it was a war zone. So it was stressful. It was difficult. It was challenging. That's what it was like. But the women never stopped coming. They never stopped coming. They would go through whatever pickets, whatever was out there. consistently.
You write that abortion clinics really fostered the growth of outpatient care in the United States. What do you mean by that?
Well, abortion is the first outpatient medical surgical procedure that's done outside of a hospital. There were clinics all over this country that were performing 300 a day, 200 a day, 50 to 100 a day, and abortion became and still is the most commonly performed outpatient surgical procedure. And because that kind of development of structure, which I was involved in setting forth, was so effective, then we have outpatient surgery for all different things, colonoscopy, orthopedics, all ambulatory surgery actually was developed from the outpatient abortion centers.
Very interesting. Nobody knows that. I had never really thought of that. I mean, it's just one example of how one part of medicine changes all kinds of other parts.
Legal abortion changed all of medicine. Every surgical procedure was done in a hospital. Slowly but surely, when it became obvious that these systems could be set up, that you could have surgery centers, that the cost of doing minor surgical procedures in a hospital, which was so overbearing, could be substantially reduced. I mean, then there was a tremendous thrust for ambulatory surgery centers. In fact, there was a lot of talk about Wall Street investing in these. This is very, very popular. But no, very few people know this. Very few people think about this. Because the word abortion is so negatively loaded that it's difficult to have an intelligent, accurate discussion.
Why do you think it's so much easier in other countries? A few years ago, I was looking on the internet and I was trying to figure out what country in the world had the lowest abortion rate. And at the time that I was looking it up, it was Holland, which has, you know, is very liberal, has legalized marijuana and everything else. They have the world's lowest abortion rate, presumably due to excellent birth control and different attitudes about sexuality.
Right. I mean, I think this country has an extremely adolescent attitude about sex. It's as if we just haven't grown up. I mean, I was discussing this before, the aspect of denial. You know, if you don't talk about it and if these young girls don't know about it, they just won't do it. And the absolute inability to connect the fact that we're living in an extraordinarily sexualized society, and that doesn't stop. So I think it's a couple of things. It's the level of consumerism and fetishism and sexuality in the culture, as well as the adolescent attitude about sex and sexuality. So it becomes pornography instead of eroticism. And this is the kind of culture we live in.
There's a poignant moment in your book where you end up calling the police because one of the protesters outside of your clinic is harassing the people going into the clinic, and the cop who comes says to the protester, "You got to see it from my point of view, what happens to unwanted children." And I wondered if you could address the issue of unwanted children.
Well, yeah, I mean, that cop, I remember him very well. He said, you know, you don't see them scalded and thrown into garbage cans like I do. And, you know, I won't say that every unwanted child that's brought to term and every person, every parent who decides to, you know, have their child brought to term and doesn't want them is going to have or treat their child negatively or have an abused child. But what happens to women? What happens to these people who are actually forced to have pregnancies come to term that they don't want to? I would think that, you know, it's an extremely difficult way to live. And it's really a kind of compulsory pregnancy. And as far as I'm concerned, the power of the state has to stop at my skin.
We're talking to Merle Hoffman about her book, Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. You write about a lot of the challenges that happened as your life went on, and there were lawsuits and accusations of fraud and evictions and all kinds of things. To what extent do you think those came at you because you were providing abortions?
All of them. all of them. You know, I mean, you have to understand, I'm the only woman who owns a licensed ambulatory surgery center in New York that provides abortions. I'm very out front. I'm not shy about talking about my beliefs and the rights of women. So I became a lightning rod, and there were multiple attacks against me. Fortunately, I survived them all.
You talk about the stealth strategies that are used. That, I mean, in other words, they haven't been able to overturn Roe versus Wade, but they've used other strategies to make it harder and harder for women to get abortions. What does that look like?
Well, this is what I was talking about before, that last year alone there were 110 anti-choice legislative attempts to pass kinds of things like forcing women to see the sonograms, listening to fetal heartbeats, 1 or 2 day waiting periods, insisting on that a physician sits down and goes over all of the issues involved, anything that they can do to put a barrier between a woman and her choice, because basically they just don't think that a woman or a young woman has the moral agency or ability to make that decision. So that's what this stealth strategy is. You know, it's really turning the entire issue back to the states again, as it was in pre-Roe v. Wade.
And there is this element in the thinking of those people about what a good woman is, and it has a lot to do with gender roles.
Oh, very much so, very much so. It's a very traditional kind of thinking where the God is at the top of the hierarchy, then comes the man, who's at the top of the hierarchy of the family, and then the woman, who's the helpmate and, you know, the good woman, good mother, who has children and doesn't kill her babies. You know, I remember a 19-year-old patient that I had, and she came in, it was her first abortion, and said, you know, I want it so much. I wanted it, to love it, to see it grow. The mother in me wanted that, but the other part knew it couldn't be. It just couldn't be. And I thought that that was an extraordinary way of putting this tension, this dilemma, that, you know, it's almost like the good mother and the bad mother, the good woman and the bad woman, and not a good woman. You're not a good woman if you're going to have an abortion because you're murdering your baby. And unfortunately, a lot of women have bought into that kind of thinking. And so there's a lot of guilt. Not that women would not feel guilty if they, you know, without that. I mean, they feel guilty about everything, from not being the right size or having the right hair color to whatever decisions they make. But so women have really been taught to feel a degree of shame that is really politically problematic, because, again, yeah, if every woman who had an abortion would own that decision and get up and say that, and all their family and friends, you'd have a majority of this country.
Well, I think it's, you know, the good woman is not only good because she's a mother, but also because she's, in that way of thinking, choosing not to challenge male authority out in the workplace, out in universities, in professions, and things like that. And it seems like the world divides into the world that thinks women should be able to do whatever they want, and that which thinks they should be mothers and stay home, and which is economically not even feasible.
Or the other part that says, well, they can work, you know, they can help support the family, but, you know, they just can't control their fertility. And you know, you started the conversation with me talking about power, and yes, the book is a lot about power. And ultimately, I see the abortion decision as an absolute power decision, and it's a power struggle. I mean, will it be the woman who makes the decision, who has to be the one who takes care of that life, or will it be the state, or men in black robes, or the federal government, or the church, or the imam, or the rabbi? And for me, it's a very simple, profound truth. It has to be the woman who makes that choice.
Over time, you began to see Roe versus Wade as a compromise rather than as a full-on victory. Why?
Because of what I was discussing, the compromise of the ability of all of the states to get around the the construction of Roe, to restrict it. I mean, we have Roe now, and yet 97% of the counties have no abortion provider. The states have really taken a great deal of authority and power in trying to and being very successful in limiting access. Although Roe has great wisdom on another level, it does recognize that there is a tension between the rights and freedom of women and society who wants to protect or see this fetus come to term. So that's why it has a gestational structure. And the woman is the ultimate arbiter with her doctor in the first trimester. The second, the state has a right to regulate. And then the third, only abortion is only to save the life of a mother. I think it has intelligence and wisdom. But yet, the decision is such that the obstructions that they have been able to pass have made it really impossible for a great many women to access services.
And as you say, the grounds on which Roe was written had to do with privacy, but not with civil rights.
Right. And this is something that I spoke to Ruth Bader Ginsburg about and has been, you know, in legal theories. The idea that perhaps the right to reproductive freedom should be written under the 13th Amendment, under the right not to be a slave, because if, in fact, you are forced to carry a child you do not want, then you are a slave to that pregnancy. I think that reproductive justice and reproductive freedom are fundamental human and civil rights that transcend privacy, in a sense. But, you know, the decision was based on Griswold and other decisions after that informed the thinking of the justices. So at this point, I don't see the development of another right to abortion under the 13th Amendment.
When you started the clinic that you have run all these years, it's called Choices, it's in Queens, you had a vision for what it would be like for women, the experience of them going in there. Describe this clinic to us and how it was what you were thinking about when you started it.
Well, when I first started it, you know, as I said, the first patient came in and I said, well, counsel her, you know, and what do you mean counsel? What do I say? What do I do? So the first thing that I developed and thought about was, yes, I have to, somebody has to talk to a patient, a woman who comes in, and in those early years comes in terrified because even though abortion now was legal, there were all these centuries of back alleys of death, of terror, of, you know, horrible, horrible things that women had to go through. So time had to be spent talking about that and reassuring a woman that, yes, this is what we're going to do. And I used to have pelvic models on my desk to show them exactly how the abortion would be performed. And then also it was necessary to find out if, in fact, they were really committed to the decision. You know, I mean, why are you having the abortion? Are you comfortable? You know, do you have support? So what developed from those early days when women, you know, had never even talked about their lives before, it's like the world opened up. So as a psychologist, because that was my academic training, I began to develop formats and ways to counsel, to do option counseling, to talk to women, to talk to the 11 and 12-year-old little ones that would come in and would break my heart. You know, and then there was the aspect of the physicians just doing the medical care, because, you know, there was a time when the doctors were, if anybody remembers who's listening, Dr. Welby, you know, they were the father figure, they were the wise men, they were the shaman. But these doctors were, many doctors were not like that. And I wanted to bifurcate that art and science aspect of medicine. I thought, let the doctors just do the technical aspects of the procedure, and the talking and the educating and the support should be from the support staff. So what I developed at Choices, along with the fact that I started to do prenatal care, because women did come in and say, oh, you know, change their minds and say, well, I really don't want to have this abortion. I want to have the child. I didn't want to refer them out. So then we started to see prenatal patients and delivered them at sister hospitals. And it all grew very organically for me. It was all to meet the needs of women as I saw them, every day and stayed with them during their abortion. So my politics doesn't come theoretically. It's really from the ground up. And the way I developed choices, what I thought of and wrote about in terms of counseling and the need for education has been translated in all types of medical care. I mean, now you have something that's called informed consent. I mean, that wasn't even thought about then. I started a breast cancer program. At the time that I did this, women went in if they had a lump in their breast, and there was no biopsy. They just removed the whole thing, and then if they saw the biopsy, there was a biopsy. I mean, they didn't speak to the woman afterwards. They did a frozen biopsy, and if in fact it was malignant, they just removed the breast when the woman was on the table. All of it was with the philosophy of patient power and educating and supporting women.
When you look at the time that has passed between when you started and when Roe versus Wade happened and the present, you've seen progress, you've seen movement backwards. How do you evaluate where we are in terms of women's reproductive freedom?
Well, I think we're definitely further than we were 40 years ago, but I see this, you know, as a generational struggle. I really do see this as a power struggle, and I don't expect it to be resolved in my lifetime. We're now 40 years, 39 after Roe, and as I say, millions of Americans have been touched deeply, profoundly by this issue. I think that more and more people are waking up to the threat, and I think it will be a struggle for a long time to come.
We're talking to Merle Hoffman about her book, Intimate Wars. What was it like for you to write this autobiography? I mean, you look back over your whole life from before you were born to the present, and to go through all of that and to relive your experiences as a young woman and all the way through. What was that like?
It was an amazing experience. And I decided to do it because it was the 40th anniversary of Choices. I started when I was 25. And the three people that I loved the most died within 2 years of each other. So I wrote the book in a lot of mourning and deep, deep loss. And it was a self-reflection. It was a reckoning for me. You know, I had spent a lifetime doing this work. And yes, every now and then questioning, looking at it, but it was action, total driven, focused action. And I wanted to take the time to go back and look and reflect and create a narrative that really resonated with me, and it did. So the process was extraordinary for me, extraordinary. Very therapeutic also.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean, you talk about, and I don't want to get into this during the interview, but the about your meeting your husband and the whole dynamics of that, and he was a kind of mentor for you, and then you outgrew him, and I just find myself thinking it's an important book for women of different ages to read and to think about and to look at their own life experience and in comparison to yours. And I wondered if you were working with younger women, mentoring them, things like that.
Oh, yes. In very many parts of my life, obviously at Choices. I also have a magazine, a feminist online magazine called On the Issues, and I have a lot of young women that work with that. I do a lot of work politically, so my whole life is a process of teaching. I hope the way I live it is a teachable moment, that my whole life has been, in a sense, a teachable life, because there are so many battles for social justice and so many things that young women and men, but young women can do to change the world from what is to what should be. And I hope that reading my book and understanding that, yes, it is a struggle and you may not get to where you're going, but the point is to just keep going, I hope that that makes a difference for them.
What do you think that people, men and women, could and should do to preserve women's reproductive freedom?
Well, the first thing that they have to do is to talk about it, to own the fact that they've had the experience with it, obviously, and to interact and engage on any level that they can. I mean, we're coming up to the presidential election. It's very obvious which party will be more defending of women's rights than the others. So, you know, just the act of being aware of that, voting, helping in any way that you can. There are a lot of online communities now that are very, very active. There's actually the Silver Ribbon Campaign that's going on this week, which is an online march for reproductive freedom. So there are things out there. There are things to do, and we need all of the energy we can get. It's just a matter of opening your eyes, becoming mindful, and doing it.
As you write in the book, I mean, Democrats certainly have been much more helpful than Republicans in terms of women's reproductive freedom, and at the same time, they don't necessarily own the right to choose just because abortion is so stigmatized.
No, they don't. And the thing that the pro-choice people have to do is hold their feet to the fire. You know, that's the problem with the movement as I see it. They're too ready to compromise. Oh, well, you know, where are we going to go? You know, the Republicans are really radically talking about taking all our rights away. At least the Democratic Party is there. Right, at least. But no, you have to draw a line in the sand. I mean, women should not have to compromise to that degree. They really shouldn't. Recently, Obama, I think on the compromise of the health care decision with the Catholic bishops, said, well, you know, abortion is about more than women's reproductive freedom. We have to realize that it is. I didn't hear an outcry. I didn't hear somebody say, no, it isn't. It is about women's freedom, you know? So that's what I mean. We have to push back. We have to argue back. We have to be there. We have to keep drawing those lines in the sand.
I think one expression of your own freedom that I thought was fascinating was that in your 50s, you realized that you had never had a child and you wanted to raise a child, and you adopted a little Russian orphan and made her the center of your life, or one of the centers of your life anyway.
Oh, yes, absolutely. I had an abortion when I was 32 because there was no way I could have a child at that time. And then there was a time that I was ready. Now, one could really say I'm a very late bloomer, which is true.
Yeah, right.
But it really, the desire came over me, and I went to Siberia twice in the middle of winter and got my little one who, when I took her home, she was 3 and a half. And now she's 10 years old and doing wonderfully. The love of my life.
Merle Hoffman is the author of the book Intimate Wars, The Life and Times of the Woman Who Brought Abortion from the Back Alley to the Boardroom. Thanks so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
It was my pleasure.